Welcomen de Anime Dodspira, the only anime podcast being adapted into a Danish political drama starring Nicolaj Coster-Waldau and Kim Bodnia.
Oh man, it was such a get. It was such a get to get Nicolaj.
I think we know who's playing who.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's written all over the character. It couldn't be anybody else, really.
There really has never been more of a dream team for weird Northern European dudes than Nicolaj and Kim. These guys, when you see them in action, you're like, God damn, I've never seen anything more Danish than this.
Is there still time to get Skarsgård the Younger on board for this one? He could really round it out.
I feel like the young Skarsgårds have been fully assimilated. If you still want like a Swedish Skarsgård, Stellan is your man.
Oh, sure.
Though sure. I did just watch him in his very long and dreary Andor performance, and he's really locked in. He doesn't have to do the voice anymore.
No, it comes out naturally.
He can just drop it on a dime. He does a couple different voices in that show, and he's got a distinctive thing, but like you could tell, like he's one of those guys that has just become Hollywood.
Sure. Well, I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to divorce him from his honestly career defining, generation changing performance as a weird CGI fishman in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. I think he's the Stallone of our time.
You know what's funny is I always think of the girl with the dragon tattoo, right?
Sure.
I don't know. I guess this is just an American thing, but every time I've seen that movie, I can't tell if he's supposed to be like creepy because he's some kind of weird creepy guy, or if he's just creepy to me because he's Stellan Skarsgård. He's just being Swedish. He's just like,
I mean, personally, tell the difference. I'm never gonna forget his performance as the weird, creepy Swedish guy from Nymphomaniac, the Lars von Trier epic.
Well, you know, Lars just tells his actors, can you just be as Swedish as possible for this this role? That's all I need from you.
I saw Nymphomaniac, both of them, once, and honestly, as with every other Lars von Trier movie that I've seen, I think once is enough and maybe too much sometimes.
I love Venturi, man. I love him.
Maybe Lars went a little bit overboard on that one.
He's got to outdo himself. That's the tragedy of the avant-garde. Mm-hmm. You always have to outdo yourself. And it's tough. At some point, you just end up doing really weird, cringe edgelord shit, and you know your career is probably over. It's very hard to walk that line. Very few people can do it.
I'm doing a rewatch of Wes Anderson's catalog right now, and I'm wondering if we've gotten to the point in his career where he's going to start waning like that. Like, what do you think Malignant era Wes Anderson is going to look like?
First of all, Malignant rocks. I won't hear anything disparaging about Malignant. Malignant fucking kicks ass.
I was not making a dig at the film Malignant.
Okay. Okay,
which is
right.
Awesome, which is great. I love
that
Malignant.
That movie fucking rules. That movie rules.
I was just using it as a descriptor for his end stage career.
Fair enough. I guess we're gonna find out because the Phoenician scheme is coming out right now.
Well, that's what prompted me to dip my toes back into his catalog a little bit. I rewatched Royal Tenenbaums last night, which I hadn't seen in maybe 15 years. And I forgot like how much I like that movie. Like I think everybody knows Wes Anderson as Wes Anderson for his auteur style, right?
He is annoying weirdo.
Annoying twee weirdo, sure.
Yeah.
I think Royal Tenenbaums really struck a balance between his worst inclinations as a director and, like, actually being a good, well-thought-out movie. And I think Gene Hackman was probably doing a lot of heavy lifting in that process throughout the movie. Because, man, I love Gene Hackman. He's great. He's great in everything.
Sure. Well, you know what I think about that movie now?
What?
As much as I like that movie, Succession is the much better version of the Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it is. It really is.
I don't think that those are comparable. That's not, like, kind of the point of the Royal Tenenbaums is that, like, they didn't have a whole lot of money in terms of things. They were well off, but they weren't like billionaires like the family in Succession. You know, they weren't
right. But it is
media
it's about,
owners.
It's about a family of dipshits squabbling over a patriarch.
Well, sure. When you reduce it to that level, yes, they are similar on that stratum.
Well, that's what it is. That's what it's about.
Yeah, but there's lots of shows about a family dysfunctional families that have father issues. That's what Breaking Bad is about.
Okay, all right. Well, you know what? Here's what I'll say. Lars von Trier could make Isle of Dogs. Wes Anderson could not make Dogville. I'll put it like that.
Wow. You skewered him with that one.
Wes Anderson's Dogville would be a fucking trip, man. That would be pretty wild. If he pivoted to that kind of shit, I would be like, I'm back in. I'm all the way in.
Well, I don't know if you watched The French Dispatch, but that was probably his most violent movie by far.
Did not watch it. Was not interested.
Okay.
Don't need to know what Wes Anderson thinks about French people.
Specifically, it was about 1960s French underground magazines. But that's...
So was Andor.
Oh, yeah, no way. No way.
Yeah. Kind of strange. Bringing it back.
Oh, boy. Okay. Let's pivot here. Let's maybe talk about some anime. Is that what this show is about?
Let me just connect the dots here, because okay. Isle of Dogs is obviously a adaptation of the famous Isle of Dogs manga, mm-hmm. written by Katsuhiro Otomo early in his career.
Yep, yeah. Well, all the dogs were way more sexy in that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, that was Otomo at his most twee. He really shed that personality as he went along, and then eventually Akira redefined him as sort of a violent sci-fi futurist, weird techno fetishist guy.
Well, I mean, Royal Tenenbaums is about a guy that's in love with his adopted stepsister.
Very anime. You're right. Very anime.
Very anime.
You don't think of Wes Anderson as horny, but then, you know, something like Moonrise Kingdom comes out and everybody gets very uncomfortable.
Listen, if Moonrise Kingdom was about Japanese middle schoolers, there would be fucking neckbeard chuds all over the internet defending it at every cost.
Okay, Nissi Oisin could write Moonrise Kingdom, but Wes Anderson could not write the Bakemonogatari series. How about that?
That's pretty good, although I would love to see just a super twee, like, incredibly symmetrical stylistically version of Bakemonogatari. That would be fun. Or like a Wes Anderson's Count of Monte Cristo adaptation. That'd be great. Come on.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I do think Wes Anderson could make a live-action Bakemonogatari, because the style of Bakemonogatari is, I mean, it has an edge to it because it's like horny and strange and violent in the way that like anime is, mm-hmm. but it also its stylistic elements are a lot like Wes Anderson's Worst Impulses, like the extreme attention to aesthetic detail are very similar. Mechanically, not necessarily stylistically, but mechanically, they're very similarly built.
Well, how so?
You know, Wes Anderson is obsessed with almost like dollhouse-like precision in his sets, you know?
Uh-huh.
He loves everything to be constructed, artificial. Nothing is grounded. He is like, you know, he is an anti-realist, right?
Well, I think that's part of his whole style, is that his entire vision for his movies is that they are essentially stage plays, but filmed and shot in 3D with like cuts, you know? And
sure.
That may sound reductive because that's just what filmmaking is. but
not these days. Nobody likes cuts anymore. Yeah, they all like oners.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're all too hopped up off that scene in The Raid.
Raid's great.
Oh,
what a great movie.
Love that movie. So, but what I'm saying is Wes Anderson started off early in his career producing, like, you know, plays in school, at college, just like art house stuff. And then later started working on script writing when he met Owen Wilson. Those two, I did not realize that those two go way, way back. They're like they've been best friends since they were like teenagers.
Yeah, Wes is the one that broke his nose.
Yeah. Well, they got into that fight about Luke. So
yeah. Don't you say shit about my brother. Yeah, but he can't act, I'm telling you.
and I think he translated his love of directing stage plays, you know, into the way he shoots a movie, and that part of that is these like immaculately constructed like set pieces,
yeah,
that all of these scenes occur in, and everything's kind of like arranged in a very specific way to try and give the scene a very specific kind of post-nostalgia feel, almost.
Yes.
Which I think is what annoys a lot of people about Wes Anderson and what attracts a lot of people to Wes Anderson about his movies. So, I mean, what does Bakemonogatari do?
Well, Nisi Oisin has a very similar relationship to theater. I don't know much about their background. I don't know if they were an annoying drama kid or whatever, though I do get that feeling. But Bakemonogatari itself is written like a stage play. It is a lot of heady dialogues where people dialogue is even stretching it, because a lot of time it's either people monologuing at each other while heavily metaphorical imagery is splashed across the screen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or it's people having these like very meticulous conversations back and forth that are intentionally anti-realist. Like these are very obviously not even meant to be conversations. They are staged back and forths. And everything that is shown to you in Bakemonogatari is representational. It is, again, like anti-realist in every single way. When you watch it, scenes will never be something that the characters are interacting with on a literal level. In fact, a lot of times in Bakemonogatari, characters will pop in and out of the actual set. Can you call something in anime a set? A background? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you can call it a set.
Yeah, it is shot like that. You know, they are a lot of static locations with not many moving parts that are used as staging grounds for these theatrical, very stage play-y type dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the characters are never even anchored into the physical space. They will move in and out. When we'll do cuts, the characters will not move from place to place. A cut moves them. We also have a lot of stuff like Wes Anderson will do where there is very intentional like close-ups that kind of are jarring. They will cut to a thing that's happening very closely. Obviously, like hands are a super important element of
hands,
like both of their styles.
Eye close-ups, mouth close-ups.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
You know, anything to highlight a slight movement, you know, those are a big part of his style.
Yes, and Nisi Oisin, at least, you know, the directors of Bakemonogatari do a lot of things where they will punctuate a sentence with a close-up of an eye moving across the screen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that, like somebody breaking eye contact or somebody biting their lip.
Sure.
Or they'll cut to, you know, somebody shuffling their foot as a period on a sentence or as an ellipses, right? And a lot of times they'll do the same thing where, like, you will have an image that is completely representational, right? That is not connected literally to anything in the scene, but will cut to that as, again, to underline a specific, let's say, turn of phrase or you know, stylistic pun or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is lost on us, again, because we don't speak Japanese. So, like, a lot of the stylistic dialogue stuff is completely lost to us, which kind of sucks, because I do find that stuff fascinating. I think Bakemonogatari is, like, really interesting and cool for all those things, and I cannot believe I never made the Wes Anderson connection, which I am now making not as a joke. Like, literally, this is a real connection.
You're having
about
this realization in real time.
Yeah, I am. I'd never thought of it before, but they are the like almost maniacal obsession with aesthetic detail are something that they share like on a fundamental level. The only difference is that, well, you know, there's no 1,000-year-old dragons in any Wes Anderson movies.
So far. I think the closest that we got would be, you know, obviously Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think
the closest Wes Anderson has made to an anime besides Isle of Dogs.
You know, that brings up a point that that always struck me kind of weird about Isle of Dogs, you know, is that it's very and this is just part of Wes Anderson's like consistent reference to all of the genre material that influenced him growing up. So in this case, that would be like you know, Ozu films and Godzilla films and stuff like that. And I feel like maybe he isn't super skilled at translating that, because at least at first glance to me, Isle of Dogs came off as very like orientalist in a lot of its like lens
that it
that it was portraying Japan through, and that always struck me as kind of weird. And I'm like, oh, maybe the Wes Anderson style isn't great for every situation. Maybe he's missing some things here in pursuit of a specific directorial voice, specifically the recurring joke in the movie about Godzilla like destroying the Japanese kids' school like every other scene. I thought that was a bit like, come on, low-hanging fruit, dude.
It is him showing his age a little bit, like what are the Japanese visual touchstones I can use in my movie? Well, what about Godzilla? It's like, there have been a few things since Godzilla. We've kind of moved on. I mean, Godzilla's great. Like, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. There might be something else you could reference. I don't know. Sadako, maybe.
Oh,
you could have
sure.
Sadako destroy the school. Why not?
Wes Anderson's The Ring. I'd watch the fuck out of that. Sure, why not?
That sounds like an AI prompt.
I know. If I'm being serious, I think that Wes Anderson could do things with a Revolutionary Girl Utena adaptation.
Yeah.
Have her like change her to like a depressed girl in a like Upper East Side New York like prep school for the Netflix American adaptation. Come on, you'd watch that. That's got ground.
Yeah. See, this is, well, if you're trying to get into it, I see what you're doing. But yes, you know, that is one of these things that I think Wes Anderson would do, and is like one of the big failures of these Netflix adaptations, in particular the Kakiguri one that just came out, which they stupidly renamed as Bet.
Yo,
I'm gonna make a Kakiguri remake. Bet. Oops, I tried to do a Kakiguri remake. It's unclear what I was trying to do.
Oop, hey, you got your kake in my garui.
Oh, please spare me. Yeah, what Wes would do is make the entire thing his own, and what Netflix cannot do is completely break from the material, but they will make completely arbitrary choices about what they do choose to modify.
Yeah.
Let's say modify out of I don't know, politeness.
if we're talking in a journalistic neutral voice here, yeah, that's a fine term
for
it.
Yeah, the passive voice.
Modification. Adaptation. They are adapting it.
Adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose
they're,
you could call it an adaptation.
They're reimagining it. Wait, no, revision is different.
They're doing a revisionist take on Kakiguri.
Okay, so let's get into it. We both watched the first episode of the new Netflix adaptation.
First episode and 5 minutes of the second episode before I could not take it.
I didn't even start the second episode.
Yeah, It was like a fucking one of those warning tones that your phone goes off when there's like danger around, like an earthquake or a
danger. Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah. And I like have to immediately dash over to it to turn it off.
Okay, so you were talking to me about it yesterday, and I had been seeing others online kind of start ripping into it the last few days since it came out. So I decided to, before watching the first episode of the Netflix show, before watching the first episode of Bet, I was unfamiliar with Kake Gurui outside of what you've talked about it a couple times on this show.
I talk about it all the time.
He does talk about it all the time. And so I went and finally dipped my toes in, and I watched the first episode of the other adaptations, the anime and the Japanese live action adaptation from 2018, and I read the first volume of the manga. So I feel like I'm in a pretty strong place right now regarding what at least the very beginning of Kake Gurui is like across these medium. And with that in mind, with that context, like you were saying, the changes they make in the Netflix show are baffling. Really weird. Really weird choices.
I am genuinely convinced it is like a right-wing psyop. I did like very close to being completely convinced.
Okay, well, you may have to explain what you mean by that, because I think I know what you're talking about, but it's specifically like the decision to make one of the evil, like, student council gambling champions, like a very visibly queer, what I'm assuming, non-binary person. I think that's part of it.
We can only assume because we could not make it to any part where they clarified.
Yeah. I'm not trying to generalize. This is a lack of knowledge that I'm admitting on my part. I could not get through the show enough to figure out what this character identifies at. So I'm just calling it like I see it.
I was going to wait around till they gave their pronouns, but their shrieking made it impossible. And this is what I mean. This is what I mean. It's like, hey, what if we, like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do the weird Netflix algorithmic thing where we're going to kind of randomly replace characters with sort of like progressive choices. You know, we're going to have more Black people in the show. We're going to have more queer people in the show. But we're also going to make them awful and like completely unlikable, so that the audience can't tell whether we are trying to be inclusive or we're trying to mock these people as awful.
I got to admit, okay, so the beginning of Kake Gurui centers around this lame high school guy. I can't remember his name, but the main dude is just kind of like a piece of shit loser who's bad at gambling. That's how you know he's a loser, because he can't gamble. And as we all know, gambling is great as long as you're good at it. And, you know, the first little arc, the intro story, revolves around him losing a bunch of money to another classmate, and he has to become her slave, basically, which is kind of something that you see pop up in a lot of high school anime. You know, the
recontextualized with a Black kid.
Yes, that's really, where I was getting
again,
at.
Again, really, you can't, that like no thought put into this at all.
Well, and then there's also the weird decision to split his character. Like his character functions as the audience insert, right? He is kind of following around.
Well, in the manga, he is like, yeah, he is the POV character. In the show, they make the baffling choice to have him as the sidekick.
Yes. Well, yes, that's a big change, because that carries through on the other adaptations, the anime and the Japanese live action is centered around him. He is the main guy. And actually, one thing that I really liked about his character in the Japanese live action show, have you watched it at all?
No, God, no.
So they made the decision to have him be an explicitly like a Greek chorus character, where he will stop the narrative around him to break the fourth wall and talk to the audience about like what the rules of the games they're playing are and sure. why everything is so crazy and what the stakes are and all that. And like, first of all, I don't think they had the budget to do the real effect where they freeze everyone around him and, you know, film him separately and then put it into that scene.
Yeah.
They just have all of the other actors and background characters just stand really still, like as still as they can.
It's really funny.
They just a freeze frame because you can absolutely see him bump into people and they shift and like people blinking in the background and stuff. It's very funny.
Sure.
But, you know, he is a Greek chorus in that version. And also, like, he is way, way, way more of a comedy relief character to the point where he is over animating his actions more than the animation is in the anime.
Weird. Where,
yeah. Like, he's doing these big, you know what he's channeling? He's channeling Nick Cage in Vampire's Kiss. That's the kind of affectation. Yes. No, he's doing these crazy, super exaggerated, like, faces and screams and, like, funny voices and stuff. He's doing, like, a Daffy Duck performance, basically. He's jumping all over the place. I honestly find his character enthralling in that one, in that version, for no other reason other than he's just so much more like animated than all of the other versions of that character, who are mostly portrayed as kind of like a milquetoast beta cuck dude, right?
Yeah, milquetoast beta cuck. Yeah, he's a Fido, as they call him in the manga.
A Pochita.
Yeah, a Pochita. Yeah, that's another detail they decided to change in the Netflix show, is they do not call the characters Fido and Mittens.
No, they just call them
the house pets.
Yeah, they just call them house pets, which is like, come on.
It's really lame.
If you're gonna do it, at least lean into the explicit fetish stuff. Come on. Give us that at least.
Well, that is a very interesting point, because here's what my biggest I don't know, confusion point, bafflement about Netflix doing this in the first place, and especially doing it with this lineup, which is, I don't know if you know who Simon Barry is, but he's the guy who did most of the work on this adaptation. He's mm-hmm. the Warrior Nun guy.
The Warrior Nun guy? What?
Yeah, do you remember Warrior Nun? Did you watch any of that?
No, I did not watch any of man. Warrior Nun, Remy.
You didn't watch Warrior Nun?
How could you even ask me that?
I watched some Warrior Nun. It is, let's just say it is late period Buffy style shit. And that's sort of Simon Barry's, like, wheelhouse.
I mean, it shows. It fucking shows.
Yeah, he is very much post-CW kind of, like, you know, Joss Whedon-like. Maybe less, a little more restrained than Joss Whedon would be, but he is like he's the gig guy, you know, who sure. comes in and does the B budget style, you know, daytime TV fantasy show.
Hey, everybody's got to eat, man. Everybody's got to have a job.
Sure, sure. Netflix, they've got to hire these giggers to do something.
They got to do something.
But he is a baffling choice because he really is like kind of the restrained, like family friendly TV kind of guy. And one of the things that is absolutely central to the entire concept of Kekeguri is that gambling is sex.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gambling is fucking. And Yumeko, basically, I mean, her character becomes fleshed out. We learn her backstory. We learn her circumstances, why she does what she does in the manga as it goes along. You know, I've been keeping up for a while. I'm on the latest chapter, so I know the whole spread. But her essence is that she just wants to come. She just wants to get a nut.
She just wants to get off? That's how you get off. Why didn't you let her get off?
Yeah, that's all she wants, man. Like, on the fundamental level, she is very mentally ill. And, like, she needs to fuck people by gambling with them. It is very much a blatant metaphor.
Yeah.
In all versions of this, except for the Netflix one. You know, like I said when I was talking to you last night, Something that happens very early on is one of the student council members, the insane punk girl with the eye patch. Mm-hmm. She masturbates with a loaded revolver in a public bathroom while playing Russian roulette with herself.
Which is cool kid shit.
It's cool kid shit for sure. I can't argue with that. But like, that is the tenor of Kakegurui.
Yeah.
You know, in the first bet with Mary, when she kicks Mary's ass and like makes a name for herself, they play the Kaiji game of rock, paper, scissors. The second gamble is with the girl who rips people's nails off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The third is the tea ceremony girl. So like, we are really not ever playing traditional gambling games throughout the series. There's a couple of times where they do play more traditional games, but there's always some kind of like absolutely fucking wild twist to them.
Well, not only are we not playing traditional like gambling games that generally are built around an actual like game of chance, there is a heavy element of randomness associated with it. In all the games they're playing in this show, in this manga, everyone's cheating all the time. It's not even a fair gamble.
Here's where I was going with this, because this is very much in my wheelhouse, right? Kakegurui is a death game. It is the subsection of death games, which is gambling death games. So it is operating in a field I am very familiar with. I've read a lot of these. You know, this is Kaiji, this is Usagoi, this is the Black Swindler.
Uh-huh.
Liar game is a big one, right? The premise of gambling death games is that you have a savant who, again, and this is downplayed in a lot of ones, like, for example, Kaiji is not getting off on this. He is just desperate not to die or be put into a slave camp.
Sure.
That's sort of his deal.
Well, hey, that's all of our deals these days.
Yeah, no kidding. It's kind of our reality. We are living in a death game. And as Kakegurui says, money is life, right?
Yeah.
You're betting on your life.
In this capitalist world,
money is life. In a gambling death game, our main character is almost never the actual main character, because they are a savant whose true nature needs to remain a mystery. This is true for almost all gambling death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we have a character like Ryota, who is the sidekick, but also the POV character, because we need somebody who is dragged into this and is constantly afraid, like just terrified of everything that's happening.
Oh, he's just pissing his pants the entire time.
Yeah, but also like learns while they go, because we need to learn while we go with the story. But the main character needs to remain a mystery and have some kind of like perverse relationship with betting their own life and well-being on these games. And Yumeko is a really great version of this, because she is, in the manga at least, and the anime a little bit, though they downplay it, she is unreadable, like a complete fucking mystery at all times. And Kaiji, he's an open book. In Usagoi, we kind of know a lot about the main character, because his whole thing is he's really standoffish and challenging. He loves to outplay people. That's his one ambition in life. In Liar Game, the dude is just desperate to save this dumbass girl who keeps putting herself in danger. But Yumeko just wants to get a nut.
Sure.
That's all we really know about her for a large amount of the series.
Well, and that's what makes the gambling chapters from Stardust Crusaders so appealing, right?
Yes.
Is because,
yes,
like Yumeko, Jotaro is unreadable. He's unflappable.
He is completely unreadable. He doesn't want to get a nut. He just doesn't give a shit. And that's
he
what
doesn't
his
give
whole
a shit about
is.
Anything except
he
for
does
marine
not
biology.
Fucking care. Yeah, marine biology is pretty cool. It's cool. Yeah. That's a cool guy thing to be into. Like whales and shit. That's cool.
Yeah.
But Yumeko is exactly like all these other gambling death game characters in that gambling itself is not particularly compelling, you know, to watch narratively, because much like watching a TV show or a movie about, I don't know, close-up magic, I'm, you know, now you see me.
Hey, now you three me's coming out.
I know. Now you see three, you mean.
I think they actually finally called it Now You Don't.
Yeah. Oh, man, I can't wait. Those movies are the stupidest things ever made. But the entire, because that is not compelling as a narrative in a piece of fiction, like that doesn't make any sense because much like televised magic, the entire trick does not matter anymore. You could very easily do a card trick if you have the ability to cut or hide things with a camera. In narratives, gambling holds no weight because there is no... you know, all outcomes have already been decided,
yeah,
right?
By it's definition, they're operating within a completely, like, predetermined, creator-controlled environment. It's a story being written. You can make it whatever you want.
It's very difficult to build any kind of tension with straight gambling. I mean, that's why even in James Bond, you get like one scene, right? And the entire idea is that, like, it's incredibly tense because the other guy... is a super murderer, you know, and that's what's scary. In these games, the whole every single challenge has to be tainted by somebody messing with the conflict, and our main character is an absolute bloodhound who deconstructs what is happening in real time to defy all expectation, and that's where all of the dramatic tension comes from. And that is why all these games, even in the ones that start off with poker, you know, like Usagoi uses a lot of like underground gambling to start off with, they will always up the bet. And what makes Kakeguri so interesting is it never tries to like start off and then escalate. It goes from 0 to 100 almost immediately, to the point where most of the games, like following the first quarter of Kakeguri, are like actual death games. Like people are, if you lose, you die. Now Yumeko is very merciful, so she does not slay her opponents, but other people do.
Well, it's,
they're like cutting people's fucking hands off and shit. It's crazy.
Pulling off fingernails and stuff. And that's something that I noticed about the Japanese live action. Is in the manga and the anime, you kind of have this ramping up of the challenges, right? Until you get to the more extreme stuff like that. It happens pretty early, but you know, you start off, you're betting for cash and social status, basically. And then you introduce the nail thing and then cutting off body parts and killing each other and shit. You know, the Russian roulette. But in
there is a tower of death. There is a tower of death.
In the Japanese live action, they intro the entire concept of the school gambling with talking about how the current president, who within the narrative is the cause, I guess, of this gambling epidemic amongst the students. Like she gambled her way into being class or school president, and then immediately implemented a hierarchical punishment game system on everybody.
Oh yes, she is a fascist dictator.
Yeah, and her character intro is kind of setting up all of this and how the school works. Literally starts with. Showing the audience, the viewer, her gambling to get her position from the old school president. And when he loses, he immediately jumps up from the poker table and jumps out the window to his death.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I'm like, oh wow, that is an interesting first 5 minutes you put there.
I don't want to spoil it, but there's one a little later when Yumeko plays again one of the other student council members, and the bet becomes so intense that during one of the final hands, he is so stressed out, his hair turns white. It's shit is really intense. And that is, you know, Netflix is not particularly interested in that part.
No.
They're more interested in setting up like Yumeko as kind of like a cheeky revenger type.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to get to is, like we said, basically the setup for the character and the way gambling works is it's a stand-in for sex, for fucking, for power and control. As the Oscar Wilde quote goes, everything is about fucking except for sex. That's about gambling. I think that's what he said.
You get the money, and then you get the power, and then you get the nut.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, hey, Pacino just wanted to nut. Why didn't you let him nut in that movie? He never got to nut.
Didn't he?
But since they're doing such a, like, edges filed off take on this whole process, this whole concept, they've decided to make Yumiko's character sympathetic in the way that she's not a high-functioning sociopath that, you know, gets sexual pleasure from winning gambling bets. She is like a trained gambling prodigy brought up by her super gambler mom to get revenge for her dad's car bombing because he was developing, what I can only assume is probably going to end up being some kind of anti-gambling computer technology. It seemed to be where they were going.
He was developing the cure to gambling disease.
Yeah. He's isolating isotopes in a lab. You know, we just need one more DNA sample and we can figure out how to get rid of gambling forever.
Gambling DNA. Would it be valuable here to kind of shed some light on the differences between, like, the actual Yumeko Jibami and Yumeko whatever her fucking name is in the Netflix show?
Yeah,
I
think so, yeah.
Okay, if this show is made early on in the comic run, then, yeah, you end up with a Full Metal Alchemist situation where you have to make some serious choices about where you're going to go with the end game because you're going to outrun the manga, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can forgive all kinds of stuff because of that. That is not the case here. I doubt this show has been in development for over 4 years. The manga is pretty well established. We know where we're at. So changing things that are absolutely fundamental to what Kakegurui is a very, very deliberate choice. And you would assume they would not make choices like that arbitrarily.
Well, I mean, I don't assume anything.
Okay, right. Ass of you and me, right. Yeah. But they change really fundamental things like, maybe if you read the manga or you've watched a little bit of the anime, you might have caught that Yumeko Jibami and Kirara Momobami have very similar sounding last names.
Mm-hmm.
That might have been something that got flagged for you. And that they seem to have an interesting, already established relationship when the series starts, even if they both play coy about it. Like, that might have tipped you off to something strange. I don't know. It's not exactly the most explicit thing, but you might be like, huh, that's weird.
Well, I mean, even the fact that they drop that Yumiko transferred to this academy specifically, like, for an undisclosed reason as of yet where I am. But, you know, she says right in the very first chapter that she wanted to go to this school, and you're meant to assume it's because she's, I don't know, a gambling freak who comes from gambling, and she wanted to go to the gambling school. But then, you know, they drop that the whole gambling thing as, like, part of the school, which they describe as a long-standing tradition that's been going on, quote-unquote, for some time, is only, like, 3 years old.
For some time.
It's only been going on for like 3 years since the class president showed up and created the gambling culture. Kids only go to Japanese high school for 3 fucking years. It can't have been that long.
Yeah, I mean, in the Jibami verse, which I guess we'll just have to lay it out like that, because I do not know what Yumeko's name is in the show, in the Netflix show.
It's Hayamoto.
Hayamoto. Okay, in the Jibami verse, the school is like 120 years old, and it's always been about gambling. The thing that Kirara establishes in the manga is the house pet system.
So she's just a freak like that. She's just into that shit.
Yes, she wants to rule the school with an iron grip because she essentially wants to take control of all of the school's money and power. She wants to, basically, the reason we almost never see the teachers in the manga and anime are because she has usurped power from the entire fucking faculty through money.
I mean, are the parents ever going to question that? Like, how they're sending their kids to a super fucking expensive private prep school, and they don't know anything because they all gamble instead of going to classes? Like, do the kids actually learn anything? Do they know anything?
It turns out you don't really need to know anything if you're rich.
Oh, shit. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And if you lose all your money, it is established that the student council will sell you. They will. And that is a gambling manga thing also. Is like, if you lose, yeah, you usually get solded for parts or other nefarious things.
I mean, they're straight up saying in the anime that if they don't pay up, you know, their debts, then they're going to go after parents. They're fucking going after parents.
Well, and very early on in the manga and anime, Mary gets sold off to a fucking senator as a child bride because she can't escape her petdom. So they make it pretty clear what happens to you.
Fucked up.
And they also make it clear that that is the student council's decision, not the faculty. Like, that is Kirara. She is doing that shit. And that is part of it, too, about how incredibly nefarious and sexually dangerous this entire endeavor is. It's something that you cannot work into a CW style, Riverdale style Netflix adaptation of this entire concept.
Mm-hmm.
But Yumeko is, like they call her in, I think, all the versions, she is a viper who has been released into the school like a kind of nefarious childhood prank. not somebody who has, like, been developed as a Terminator. She is a person who has a lot of issues, and somebody has decided to drop her into the middle of a fascist dictatorship and just to see what happens. That's really more what's going on in the manga.
Yeah. And which is a fun hook. You know, it's great. I love that trope when it shows up in stuff. The outsider who is secretly a badass at whatever this specific thing that we're all doing is, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're the unassuming character who comes in from outside and, oh shit, they're actually the best at thing. We all thought we were the hottest shit at thing, but they're actually the best. I like that. That's great. The thing is that in real life, when you do that, they usually just end up joining the fascists. Because
yeah,
that's like where all the power and influence is, which is usually what they want, you know. And I guess that's where Yumeko is different, because she is literally an American psycho. She just wants to see the world burn and get off. And she just wants to nut. She just wants to come. She's very frustrated.
She just wants to nut. She could not care about anything else. It's made very clear. And so the very first thing the Netflix show changes is her entire character and motivation, and also the way she talks and what she does and her last name and her backstory and her relationship to all the characters in the show, except for Ryota, who they have renamed Ryan, by the way.
Well, yeah, Ryan. But that was the other thing I wanted, is that for some reason they decided to split Ryota up into two characters. You have Ryan,
baffling,
who is kind of like the mewling, subservient one. And then you have other guy who embodies the kind of audience POV aspect of Ryota's character, where he's the guy who, in the Netflix show, he's kind of set up as the non-participant, you know? He's not playing the game. He sees all of this bullshit and he hates it, so he's just not engaging with the gambling at all. Which,
yeah,
you know, War Games 1986, the only winning move is not to play. Come on. We all know that.
It's not true, though. No, I disagree. That is not true.
You disagree.
I think you can win while playing. I think, actually, that's one of the ways to win, is play. I don't know. I think that's true. I think I've always disagreed with that.
I mean, some would say that engaging with the game at all is losing, whether or not you win the specific challenge in the moment. You've already lost morally.
I would say you cannot lose a game you don't play.
Or the other way to say that is that you win every game that you don't play.
I would say you also don't win any of the games you play.
Hey, it's not about winning or losing. It's how you play the game.
You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Somebody told me that. And I think that's true.
That was my close personal friend, Wayne Gretzky. who also gets off from winning.
Yes, who is also a
every
sick
time
freak.
He shot a every time he shot a goal, he came right on the ice.
Yeah, that was his nut. He's cracking that nut.
So yeah, we've completely changed Yumiko's character. We've split up Ryota into two characters that don't particularly do anything like well individually that you couldn't have just done by keeping him as one character. We've changed most of the student council characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Council of Bosses is one of the oldest anime tropes, where you have a evil organization of higher-ups, right, that each have their own quirks and maybe their own henchmen, and they're a colorful cast of villainous characters.
Yeah.
It's one of the things we all love about anime. And in this one, in Kakegurui, we've got what? We've got the idol, kind of the school idol council member. We've got the president. We've got the tea ceremony lady, eye patch crazy chick, and I think a couple others. The lady that wears
original?
A mask. Yeah, in the original.
Oh, yeah, we've got eye patch lady, the Kigurumi, mm-hmm. The kid who pushes his glasses up, you know, the nerd guy.
I love glasses guy in every iteration.
We have the sycophant who's mm-hmm. in love with the student council president.
The silent character that wears a mask.
The silent character who wears a mask, who is the president's sister.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, who
mm-hmm.
else? I think that's pretty much it.
Did you get the little streamer one? The one who wears like the teddy bear like costume.
Yeah, the Kigurumi yeah. girl. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in the Netflix adaptation, we've kind of cut that roster down by half. I think after Mary, who gets eliminated from the student council in the first episode.
Yeah, not a student council member in the original either.
No,
she's
not
just
in the original.
A dipshit.
Yeah. In this one, she's part of the student council because I guess anybody that wins enough money just gets to be part. If you're part of the top five, you're in the student council. Those are just the rules for some reason. She loses all of her money and gets dropped from the council. There's like four. There's eye patch. There's non-binary person.
You would, but no, potentially non-binary.
Yeah,
person.
potentially non-binary person. I don't make assumptions. I'm very staunch on that point. We've got council president and her bodyguard, who is the silent mask character, but in this version, for some reason, is wearing like a medical face mask.
A surgical mask, yeah.
Yeah, a surgical mask. Instead of, in the original version, it's like a full-on, like, I don't know what you call it, like one of those Commedia dell'arte masks, like the smiling...
Yeah, she wears a smiley face mask.
Yeah.
Which has its own whole story, too, which is, again, another baffling choice. It kind of makes you feel like, oh, well, they just decided they were going to get canceled beforehand, so why even bother with something like that?
Yeah, why bother? And eye patch lady is in there. So I think that's five total. And it's just, I don't think it works. I don't think it works in live action because the inherent campiness of it is so very much lent to being animated or being drawn, you know? It's the same thing with all these adaptations. If you try and portray something exactly like it is on the page in live action, it almost always comes off looking either cheap or goofy and unbelievable, right? And I think that you have to lean into the medium to kind of to do that adaptation correctly. But in this case, doing that would rob these characters of any identifying, like... characteristics that they have to begin with, because otherwise it would just be a council of five school kids. like just
wearing the same outfit.
Yeah, all wearing the same outfit. But when you try and give them all like super outlandish, quirky, like visual signifiers, and then on top of that, try and conform them into that algorithmic like demographic hitting that we get, it comes off bizarre. You know, like for some reason they decided to make eye patch person also like heavily influenced off of 80s goth look for some reason.
Yeah, they made her a goth instead of just like a delinquent girl,
because I don't think that there is like an American like cultural comparison for the Japanese delinquent girl archetype, right?
Well, I mean, there is. I mean, we have punks here, you know.
Punk is different. Punk is different than a delinquent, I feel.
Okay, well, then you have, geez, how do we even describe it? You have the kids who bring vodka and their water bottles to school.
Yeah, yeah. No, they have delinquents and we have alcoholics.
And those are not the goth kids, in my experience.
No, I mean, they're not, you know, the goth kids. They're usually the principal's kid or the French teacher's kid.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? Every once in a while, usually the goth kids are fine sulking and smoking cigarettes out in the back cuts of the school. They're usually not that kid.
Listen, if this school had a goth subgroup, they wouldn't want to be part of the gambling anyway. They're above that shit.
Yeah, they would not gamble.
They just want to go listen to their Visual K bands behind the school and smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, they don't have the libido for gambling. They don't want to get nuts. They just want to be sad.
Yeah, they want to get that sadgasm on. They don't want regular gasms.
Yeah, we need the daredevil girl to be the fucking gun girl who, like, again, I'll say immediately, like after her second introduction scene, goes to the bathroom and masturbates with a loaded revolver.
Hell
which
yeah.
Is more of the kind of show we are dealing with. Mm-hmm. That is, again, not a thing that Netflix is willing or potentially able to actually do.
So
somebody could. I truly believe somebody could. Not, Simon Barry.
Not Simon Barry. I got off my path what I was trying to say, but what I was trying to get at is in the live action version, this student council evil, like the boss group, you know, the council of bosses.
Yeah.
They come off looking like they just came out of a Kakegurui cosplay, like competition, low budget cosplay competition. And I don't mean to say that the clothes looked cheap per se. They look, you know, like a well-budgeted Netflix TV show.
Yeah.
But the way everything is composed and put together, it is like they were constructed with this like intent of, all right, how do we make sure people absolutely recognize that we're doing Kakegurui, because every other decision is adding up to be like, to make this show unrecognizable from the source material.
And I think that's also, there is this instinct on these adaptations to try to out clever the audience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about the comparisons to like Wednesday, right? Which
yeah.
is sort of something similar ish though. You know, nobody in the Addams Family ever masturbated with a loaded revolver.
Well, not on screen.
Yeah. Not on screen. But you know, they would make sexual entendres about corpses.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, a rigor mortis joke here and there. Never hurt anybody.
You know, it's a little more tame. You know, it's nothing in the Addams Family is as aggressively horny as, like, literally pick a random page in any fucking chapter of Kakegurui. Man, did you watch the ending credits when you watched the anime?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the ending credits and the opening title sequence,
yeah.
Which are both, like, just straight up, like, oh, I see what we're doing here. I see what we're doing.
This is a show about fucking.
The intro animation literally has the antagonist characters set up in sexual poses on a dinner table while Yumiko, holding a knife and fork, makes lustful gazes at them.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah, she wants to consume them in a sexual way. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really driving it home.
And then the ending credits is just close-up shots of her tits and ass as yeah, as her skirt slowly hikes up.
It could not be more aggressively sexual. It could not. You couldn't make a joke out of it because it's so fucking intentional. It's absolutely insane. Netflix, I don't think there is a single thing on Netflix that even comes close to how sexual Kakiguri is.
No.
Except for Kakiguri.
Well, shit, I don't know. Remember when Netflix used to be like leaning into that? Remember Sense8? You remember that?
I do remember Sense8. I don't think that was really comparable sexually. That show was definitely sexual, but it did not have it didn't have a predator vibe, I'll say.
You know, you don't mean that it wasn't like it wasn't sexually dangerous.
It was not sexually dangerous. Yeah.
Because the whole premise of Sense8, if you recall, was that there are people that can read each other's minds, and when they read each other's minds, they come.
Yeah, they are psychically connected to each other's nut.
Yeah. Which honestly, nightmare scenario.
Yeah,
for me.
No, awful. Like, what if you had The Shining but just for sex? It's terrible.
Wait, don't say that. Now you're gonna give Steven a new idea for a book.
Oh God. Yeah, he's got plenty of ideas. He's just redoing the old ones at this point.
Mm-hmm. What was the other thing that, besides the like strange narrative and character changes that they make in this adaptation, just the sheer amount of like laughably bad writing that is present in the episode, like divorced from it being an adaptation of something, like if you just presented this like to an audience apropos, and just like, yeah, I wrote every word in this. This is my script. We wrote it. We made it. It's a really bad script. Like, I cannot believe in the first 10 minutes of the show, she says, in Japan, they called me Kakegurui. It's baffling. It's like,
baffling.
You know, it's script writing 101 mistakes. Sarah Connor never turned to the camera and said, and that's why we call him Terminator 2. Judgment Day.
It's like he's some kind of Terminator 2.
or her entire conflict with her roommate that she shows up with, which I still don't understand what happened there. So, you know, Yumiko shows up to the new school, which is a boarding school in this version.
Yeah. She immediately beefs with her roommate, like you do.
Yeah, and says, hey, by the end of the week, you're going to voluntarily.
No, by the end of the day.
By the end of the day, you're going to voluntarily give me your bed because I want to sleep where your bed is. So we have to switch now.
Well, she wants to be dominant.
She wants to be dominant because she gets off on it. And then, you know, she goes and she publicly humiliates the Mary. They do their game, which also they change the game that they play. I'm getting sidetracked here again, but they change the game from the rock, paper, scissors voting game.
Yeah.
To just straight up, they're playing war, basically.
Yeah.
They just take a hand of cards and lay them down flat and turn them over one at a time, and whoever has the higher card wins. And I also noticed for some reason, they're playing for vastly lower amounts of money in these games.
Yes, they're playing for way less money. It's kind
of
funny.
Part of the setup of the entire premise is that this school is for the financial and political elites' children, where they go to learn to be little sociopaths, right? That learn gambling, like mood reading techniques, so that they can all succeed in their horrible bourgeoisie rich kid lives. And you know who fucking likes rich kids? Nobody likes rich kids.
Fuck rich kids.
Fuck rich kids. But the rich kids in the Netflix version, they're all playing for like $20, $50, Whereas in all of the Japanese versions, the anime, the manga, and the Japanese live action, they're playing for like tens of thousands.
Not tens of thousands. No, in game one, Yumeko loses $200,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're playing for millions of yen in the Japanese version, but that basically translates to tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars. On the first day, like, that's the kind of money, the stakes that they're playing with. And with that set up, it makes sense as to why they escalate to basically death games at that point. Once money stops being like something that people give a shit about because they all have so much of it at a high level, then you have to start playing for the fun stuff, you know, like lives and fingers. And fingernails.
Ritual humiliation.
I cannot see in the Netflix adaptation going from like, yeah, you just lost $200 to now you have to cut off your arm.
Or we're selling you into sexual slavery.
Yeah. Yeah. Or we're selling you into sexual slavery, selling you into factory work, into the mines. Do they still send kids to the mines?
They cut them up and they take all of their organs out.
So they change that. They change the game that they're playing, which I feel that alone makes the characterization of how the school works so much different. Because in the original one, the reveal is that all the kids that are in the room watching Mary and Yumiko do the rock, paper, scissors game, like at least 2/3 of them are in on it and helping Mary cheat, including Ryota, our POV character.
Yeah.
In the Netflix adaptation, they change it so that it's just Ryan, and not even both Ryans, just the black Ryan, who's helping Mary cheat.
God damn it, black Ryan.
Lay off black Ryan. He's at it tough, all right?
Hey, he didn't want to help her cheat. He was forced to
because he was a house pet.
Oh, God damn it. Again, it's so fucked. You can't
it's so
say
fucked.
That.
It's so fucked.
You can't say that.
There's so many things just come off like bafflingly, bizarrely insensitive or offensive. And it's like they either didn't think about it or they did not care. And I don't know which is scarier in this case.
This is why I said it's a psyop. This is a psyop to, vice signal to like weird reactionaries. I really think that's the case. Look at these terrible blue hairs.
You know, and back to what I was saying about her roommate is she comes back at the end of the episode and her roommate has switched beds with her voluntarily and also given her a bunch of money because I guess that's just how the school works. And I guess we're meant to infer that she like so thoroughly publicly humiliated Mary that her roommate like doesn't want to mess with her. But they do not really convey that well at all because they do the roommate thing at the very beginning of the episode as soon as she gets to the school. Then everything happens. And then right before the credits hit, you come back and you just see that Yumiko's stuff is on the other bed now. And there's a note on the bed that just says, "You win," like from her roommate. And it really comes off as just like being a total afterthought of like, oh, we forgot about this bet she made with a roommate. Let's just make it so that she wins. She just wins. She just wins
the roommate saw what happened and was so intimidated that she didn't want to mess with her new roomie because she's a badass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm not even going to put up a fight. Even though that's what the school is about, and that's the first thing she says is like, "You gotta fight.
You gotta fight.
You gotta fight." It's like, what would this version of Yumeko even do? I don't understand.
I have no idea. Presumably, I don't know. Say something real witty. That seems to be her stand-in because you know the visual cue in the anime and the manga for shit hitting the fan, right? Is everyone doing the crazy face.
When everything breaks down and your true face shows through and you realize, oh, your soul is ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone has an anime face.
It's now in public.
You have your standard anime face characters, but then they do the Ren and Stimpy thing where when shit hits the fan, you get a close-up and they get wrinkles and their eyes get really small.
Yeah.
And they do the crazy face. And that's like that's the visual thing. Now, in the live-action Japanese adaptation, they did probably the worst way that you can go about adapting this, which is they translated literally onto the screen and they use CGIs to animate the characters, like irises and pupils getting smaller within their eyes. Like they get fake anime crazy faces in the live action one. And Yumiko's eyes, you know, they actually make her eyes glow red with CGI whenever she's like in the zone doing her gambling thing. Whenever she's getting off, they literally put little CGI flames in her eyes. I guess if I had to say one kind thing about the Netflix adaptation is that they chose not to do that. They just decided to have the character do nothing. Instead,
we chose to do nothing.
Yeah, we chose to have the character not have facial expressions instead of just doing them extremely badly, which, you know, like I said, the only winning move is not to play.
they should have given her the red eye contacts. Man, it's like, come on, just do it. What are you scared of?
Well, I mean, having watched the Japanese live action, I can see what they're scared of because it does look goofy. It looks
goofy as hell.
It looks goofy as hell. But I think that at least in the Japanese live action, they really lean in, like with Ryota, like I was saying earlier, they lean into over-exaggerating every motion and character in the live action Japanese version, specifically because I think that they're trying to outdo or at least live up to what is presented on the page. You know, we cannot make this paced in the same way that you watch it in the anime or read it on the page, but we can provide such over the top performances that you're not going to be thinking about those to begin with. I respect that a little bit. It comes off goofy as hell, but in a very campy tongue in cheek way where I think that they knew what they were doing. And I always like, I have a soft spot for that kind of self-awareness. They do not have that in the Netflix adaptation. Like I said, they just choose not to do anything.
They just don't do anything.
They just don't do anything. They do a total Keanu on it.
They pull a Keanu on it. He doesn't do anything. Yeah, it makes the choice to just not do anything, and I find that very strange because in most anime adaptations, the problem is what is happening on the page or in the anime itself, in the animation, is unfilmable. That's kind of the whole thing. That's why a lot of people go, well, these are all bad. Because, you know, when you do Dragon Ball Z, how do you fucking visually represent going Super Saiyan without it looking stupid? It is incredibly easy to make somebody playing a card game, like, translate to screen. Like, putting aside all of the dramatic tension elements that are hard to recreate, all of that stuff, every single thing that happens in the anime in the first episode is supremely filmable.
Yeah.
You could make if you gave me one camera and enough actors, I could make episode one of the anime in in live action very easily.
In a weekend.
You could copy this shot for shot, and it would translate incredibly well, especially because the anime makes a bunch of really great directorial choices. You know, just using camera work, which is what you have to do when the entire show is about people playing games. In the Netflix adaptation, instead of choosing to do the easiest and most successful route, which is do what the anime did well, they choose to do none of it. They choose not to do anything.
choose to not do.
Yeah. I mean, if you're curious at all, just watch, the first bet. of the anime. Watch the rock, paper, scissors game.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Just look at what the camera is doing and what the characters are doing, and how they shoot faces and how they shoot action, how they use framing to replace doing like weird effects that would be in other anime. And tell me that is not easily transmissible into a live action show. It's the simplest thing they could have done, and they chose not to do it. Baffling. Absolutely baffling.
I really think that you should go watch at least the first episode of the Japanese live action series just to see what I'm talking about here, because as goofy and as like weird and bad as it was, at the very least they are attempting their best to do exactly what you just said, which is translate what was good about the anime and the manga onto a live action screen. It really highlights the decisions that were made in the Netflix adaptation. Like, it just makes them that much more confusing in so many ways. I don't know.
Baffling.
Yeah. Oh man. Oh geez. I think
swing and a miss.
Who ordered this?
Why was this the one that they wanted? I don't understand. I mean, I know the anime did pretty well on Netflix. They aired both this and Kakegurui Twin, which is the prequel spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I know people were watching it, but this isn't One Piece.
It's no One Piece.
This isn't Death Note. Kakegurui, as much as I like it, and, you know, again, it has huge, huge glaring problems. Kakegurui is not showing up on best anime, best manga lists of all time. You know, that is not happening.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. It's like, it's pulp schlock. That's what it is. It's exploitation.
It's death game gambling.
Very much so. It's about horny high schoolers gambling and making cum faces at each other.
It's a death game gambling manga. There are so many of them. Like I said, I've read a huge amount of these. Casino's another good one.
Mm-hmm.
Usagoi really would have been my choice if you were going to do anything, because that one has more of a Netflixy feel, to be honest. And it is much bigger.
I'm just pissed that they keep putting out adaptations of stuff like Kakegurui and Death Note and One Piece, but where's my big budget Netflix adaptation of Sono Bisky Doll or Nagatoro, huh? Where's my Gyaru Slop? Where's that?
You want the Gyaru Slop?
I want to see what they'll do with it.
Maybe they genuinely don't know how to translate gyarus into American high schools.
So they're just like, they're girls, but I don't understand.
Okay, so the thing is, they're girls and they wear their school uniforms wrong. And then they're like, what's a school uniform?
I mean, an American adaptation of a Gyaru comic would be about like alt girls, right? Like emo girls.
It would be Mean Girls.
Yeah, it would be Mean Girls.
It would be Mean Girls.
It would be Mean Girls.
Mean Girls are Gyarus.
But that's where you lose a bit in translation, because Mean Girls were popular and rich, and Gyarus are generally seen as low class, right?
You know, it depends from, it varies from region to region.
All right. Well, I don't want to get sucked into another conversation about Gyaru today. Save that one for a later episode.
Okay. Just pick one thing besides Gyaru. Give me one thing you think they should try next.
Oh man. Okay. All right. Live action Netflix adaptation of Ghost in the Shell. Wait, no, fuck. Speed Racer. No. Oh shit. Battle Angel Alita. Oh shit. Oh no. Dragon.
You have nothing. Nothing.
Well, there's a lot. There's a lot. Oh wait, what about Cowboy Bebop? Wait, fuck. Oh shit. You know what? Actually, in that vein, if we're doing that, if we're going to continue on, they like to snipe nostalgia shows, right? Anime that people grew up watching in the 90s and early 2000s.
Yep.
That they have nostalgia for it now.
Yep.
I posit that the next big budget Netflix anime adaptation is going to be a live action Trigun. And it's going to be set in the American school system in the 2010s.
You know what? I I would not put money against them doing something like Trigun. I honestly, that does make a lot of sense to me.
In my home country, Japan, they called me Trigun.
They called me the Trigun. Here's what I'll say. Here's the one I want.
Mm-hmm.
I would love an Akumetsu attempt. Akumetsu, of course, you'll remember, is the one where the guy goes around torturing politicians. which is really great. And it turns out that he has like hundreds of clones of himself. So they every time they kill a politician, they also kill themselves with the politician.
Yeah.
Which is just so fucking hardcore. instead of one shot, one kill, his policy is one man, one kill, which is fucking, that's fucking hard.
I mean, if you could infinitely clone yourself, if I had clone powers, yes, hell yeah, I'm making assassin clones. That kicks ass.
When he says that shit, one man, one kill, that goes so fucking hard. As for what they might actually attempt to do, I think an HBO style of Urasawa Naoki's monster would be like the actual thing they might actually give a shot.
Oh, a high budget prestige television adaptation of Monster? I can see that. I can see that.
You know, this has been tried before. There was sort of a lower budget live action movie that I did not watch, and the anime, which again did not get the budget it deserved for how incredible a masterpiece that is. But I do see them attempting something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not Akumetsu, but I'd be very interested to see how they fuck that one up. Speaking of girls getting horny over atypical things, can I just, before we bounce out, can I tell you about like a couple of the shoujo mangas I've been reading?
Okay, real quick, because we're already over time.
Well, real quick, I won't go super hard.
All right,
who am I, you?
Fair enough.
I've read a couple of different things recently. I've been trying to read more shoujo manga because I feel like I've been neglecting it in my recent glut. You know, we talk about a lot of shoujo manga, but it's usually your choices. I want to talk about some of mine for once. Usually I read horror ones, like horror shoujo, which I find to be a great... It's truly the chocolate and peanut butter of manga for me.
Well, like how Yumiko can't get off without gambling, you can't get off without having some kind of horrible existential dread present within the romance.
Exactly. And I'll, you know, like this one, for example, by one of my absolutely new favorite mangaka who I adore with all my heart, Sachiko Uguisu, or Sachiko Hiyodori, which I think is her pen name. This one's called Tokimeki no Ikene, or Heart Throbbing Sacrifice.
Okay.
Which is about sort of like a loser, like manga girl who comes across like the popular boy in class one day who's been hit by a car, and she like helps him to the hospital, saves his life. And the next day he comes up and asks her out, and she's all freaked out. And usually in that scenario, the twist here being that like in every shoujo manga, that would be because she has low self-confidence, right?
Mm-hmm. Like Honey Lemon Soda.
Yes. And she learns to like, you know, respect herself. Well, it's some shoujo. In a lot of shoujo, she would never learn to respect herself. She would just kind of go with the flow. In this one, we find out the reason she's so hesitant is because she comes from a family of cultists who do blood sacrifices to a demon god.
Hell yeah.
And if the popular boy found out, he wouldn't like her anymore. which is so fucking great. I loved it so much.
Oh, my crush won't like me if he finds out my family are literal Satanists.
Yeah, exactly. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful little story. I love it very much. That's usually the stuff I'm reading, so I did want to expand out a little bit. So I read a more traditional one that I thought the concept was very funny. I read one called In the Clear Moonlit Dusk. Have you heard of this one?
No.
It's a pretty standard shoujo manga. You can kind of extrapolate it out. But the twist in this one is that we've talked about the concept of the prince, right?
Sure. Usually like a tomboyish character who is the, I'll say platonic, like crush of all of the girls in school, right?
Yes. Yeah. She is a handsome woman,
mm-hmm.
and she is gallant, and so everybody refers to her as a prince, because girls are, you know, in that safe, again, Freudian juvenile sexuality way.
Yeah.
Excuse me for those psychology. All the girls in class like fall in love with her, and in this one, that is our main character. And girls are constantly coming up and giving her stuff, which I find is such a weird thing, like cookies and towels and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's so weird. I never gave a crush a towel.
I think part of that is just, I think it's just a cultural difference with the, because you see it all the time in manga and anime, the extreme deference to and obsession with ranking and hierarchy within the school system, right?
Yeah.
It's all over Kakegurui, obviously. In addition to the house pet system, they also just rank people by literally how much cash they carry on hand at any given time.
The platonic ideal of capitalism.
Yeah. And so it happens all over the place in anime and manga, and I think part of that is it's just kind of accepted that, like, yeah, of course you want to suck up to the person who's above you. Why wouldn't you? That's how you get up.
Well, you know, sexual capital, right? They call this pretty privilege.
Yeah.
But in her case, she is sad because this situation, and I guess you kind of never really think about it in the other situations, but she never receives any attention from men. And, you know, she's kind of given up on that idea because now she's just boxed into the idea of the prince. But as she finds out, her school has another prince, which is a super tall, incredibly hot, rich boy who is also kind of a bad boy. And one day he bumps into her and is like, "You are so fucking hot." And this changes her life forever. So I found that is very funny. That is just a funny principle.
So he's into girls that look like him.
Yeah. Well, no, they don't look the same because he's like a bad boy and she's the prince, right? The upstanding gallant girl.
Okay. All right.
And her whole deal is that, like, oh, only girls have ever been into me. And so this is really fucking me up. So it's a girl who gets off on male attention, but for the first time ever, the first one, it's a girl who gets off on blood sacrifice. The second one is a girl getting off on being seen as a girl, which is just very funny to me. The third one I read, which I think is very notable here because it's about adults, is a shoujo manga about a woman who writes shoujo novels, but finds herself in her 30s. Her career is drying up because she has basically written the same book like 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
And her editor tells her that under the pretense of gathering information for a new style of book, basically tells her to, like, go see a prostitute, a male prostitute. And the woman is like, why would anyone ever see a male prostitute? And she eventually caves and gets a male prostitute. And it turns out to be someone she knows. And of she's course. Conflicted about it. But ultimately, it's a super hot dude. So she's like, hell yeah. So it's a woman getting off on male prostitution. And the final one is, this is the one that's most literal because it relates so heavily to Yumeko Jibami. The final one is called "Even If I Die With Miss Asanami, I Want to Come."
I mean, you know, shoot your shot. Yeah. Do what makes you happy.
Which is a very standard, and this one is sort of a male, the standout one because it's a more of a male perspective, I guess, rom-com-ish, less of a shoujo, but it is about two student council members, one who is sort of like an upstanding, nice boy, and the girl who he has a crush with, who gets insanely horny about murder.
I mean, who doesn't?
Hey, you know, people are into what they're into. And she's usually like a nice, quiet girl, but every once in a while she starts describing in incredibly overly intricate detail how to murder people. And this turns her on so much that she becomes like an entirely like sexual being that like freaks him out. But he's kind of into it because she's like his crush, you know? And then eventually they form a love triangle between him, the murder girl and the girl who desperately wants to get murdered because that's the only thing that can make her come.
Well, I mean, if the guy isn't into it, then the message of the manga seems to be it's better to be in a relationship with someone who gets off from the literal idea of murdering people than it is to be single.
Look, they're in high school. Like, you don't think about these things when you're in high school. I thought this one in its own particularly horror style way was kind of interesting. It never got the chance to get off the ground because it got canceled very early, but there is some interesting stuff in there. But these are all the things I've read recently that I was thinking about while watching Kakeguri, because obviously Ryota, very underplayed in the manga, at least his crush on Jibami. They really avoid it a lot, even though it's kind of made explicit that he's really into her, and like in her own way, she kind of is affectionate for him, but obviously has a hard time showing it because she only gets off on gambling. This is like just other things I've been reading about girls getting off on unconventional things. That's my connection. So, you know, in manga, this is a thing that's being explored. You could call it kink. I'm not sure if I would go that far.
I would. Very readily so. I would call this.
Yeah.
This is fetish content. Specifically, Kakegurui is fetish content. You can tell by the way it's supposed to make people horny when they watch it.
By how horny it is.
Yeah. By how every character, every female character at least, is constantly bending over in such a way that they're constantly flashing their underwear at the camera, which is animated, so you know they just drew it like that. It's not like the camera fell on the floor. They drew it that way.
Oh, yeah. And it goes so much farther than other anime. And it's almost one of those things where I kind of respect it, because it's like, we're not even going to fucking play coy. Like other anime, it's like, oh, whoops. Like the girl fell over in a way that like, maybe you kind of like see her underwear. In this, it's like, we are not fucking around. Hey, look, it's her underwear.
Get it?
Do you get it? Idiot? Look, here you go. You want it? Here it is. We're not fucking around here, okay? You know what we're doing. And you know what? If it's a choice between the two, I choose Kakeguri every time.
Oh, boy. You need fucking help. We need fucking help, man.
Hey, this look, I find it way more
sustainable.
I find it way more disgusting when it's like, did you notice? Oh no, like we were it was on you. Like we weren't even like doing it. It was like by
accident.
Obviously
being upfront, obviously being open with your intentions is the better route. It doesn't make it less gross, and it doesn't make me any better of a person for pointing it out. We're all down here. We're all down here in the mud that is anime. This is just the way it fucking is, I guess. Now, this is my life.
This is how it is in war, okay?
Yeah, all right.
Things get dirty.
Is that enough? Is that enough talking about...
That's enough. That's
this
enough.
This fucking Netflix adaptation. Fuck you, Netflix. Yeah, God damn.
We talked about it way more than we should, and we still didn't get into my actual point about it, but that's fine. That's fine. don't worry about it. It's really bad. It's very, very bad. And it shouldn't exist. And I think that's all we really need to say about it.
Shouldn't exist.
Swing and a miss.
All right. People, thank you again, handsome, tall, and beautiful listeners. Like, subscribe, do the stuff. Instagram,
you're
YouTube.
Welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you. And bye.
A lot about Species.
Well, it's about an alien who fucks you then kills you, and she's a sexy lady.
No, I remember that part. I remember that part very well. The other parts are a little blurry.